I'd like to call the Transportation Finance Division to order. And one announcement for members in the audience, we don't allow clapping and we don't allow signs. So if you have a sign, you'll either be asked to leave the audience or make certain you can raise your hand. And also, if you have any cell phones, they do interfere with our, we have to keep a recording. So turn off all your cell phones or other electronics. But specifically, no signs are allowed or we'll just recess the meeting. A resident sailor, you have a bill up? Represent Taylor, House File 571. The chair will move that House File 571 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. You read? Yeah, we've heard this in policy, but basically we're discussing the finance portion. Or do you have a, you want me to delete all amendments? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I should move maybe perhaps to delete all amendments?
Yeah, please. Thank you.
The chair will move. Delete all amendment 8051DE2. Any questions about the delete all amendments? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Delete all amendments. Approved. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Well, this little mini truck bill has gone through several convolutions, and I would say that now the folks that brought this to me initially wanted to use it a lot for checking their irrigators, and I will have to tell them that I feel it's now sufficiently watered down that they will be able to do irrigators quite nicely with it. At any rate, this bill, at this point, you know, there's, within this, the DE2 is just the same description of what a mini truck is. That hasn't changed. The thing that has changed significantly is at this point now we just have the authority of a county, city, or town to permit the mini truck operation, you know, between sunrise, sunset, when visibility is clear. Basically, it's left up to the counties or the towns to allow these to be permitted. It's not, now they will still not be able to drive the mini trucks on the state highways. So from what I understand, and I think that the state, Department of Vehicle Services and the State Patrol will confirm that their objections have been removed, and that's why we don't have a fiscal note. It won't need to go to finance for that reason. The bill is now in the same state or shape that it is in the Senate, and where it's gone to the House floor. But what this bill will still do is it will allow these farmers the opportunity to use the mini trucks to move, you know, equipment, small equipment, rent a town if they can get a back road, as long as they get permission by permit from their county board to do so. They will have that option. And it's okay with the counties as well. I checked with them again.
Any questions, the representative? Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Taylor. So I've had a few emails on this thing. I'm just kind of curious, that does this mean that they can actually drive these across the road if it's approved by the county?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stevenson, yes. They are allowed on the roads that the county designates, and they're also able to cross a highway at an intersection, but they cannot drive on the state highways.
Further?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? If not, no other testifiers. For or against?
Yeah.
The chair will renew his motion that House File 571, as amended, be recommended to pass and put on a general register. All in favor, say.
Have we got a phone?
No, we don't. We'll temporarily hold it, Representative Taylor. I'll withdraw that. And we got a quorum now?
Representative Scott's here.
Oh, she is? One. You need 11. You counting me? We'll temporarily hold this till we get a quorum. So if you just want to be seated for a minute, we can drop the next bill or get the next bill up.
Thank you.
Let's see. Anyone of our members, are you aware that some of the members want... Well, we've got a quorum now. You are the quorum, Representative Hortman, so we're ready to vote. This is,
Carrie, can you read one more?
Beg your pardon? This is a vote on House File 571, the mini truck. That's right, too. Representative Saylor, if you want to come back up to the...
But you can't vote.
We probably have to back up. We didn't have a quorum when we... approved the Doolittle Amendment. So I'll move the Doolittle Amendment again. That's 80571DE32 or E2. Are there any questions on the lead on amendment? Not all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary, the amendment is approved. Now, the chair will move that House File 571 as amended be recommended to pass and put on the general register. Any comment or discussion? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary, House File 571 is passed, Representative.
Thank you.
The next bill up is House File 1221, Representative Brown. Is she in the audience? Someone moving Representative Buns, House File 5. Representative Horton moves House File 421 to be recommended to pass and referred to return to the Finance Committee. There's no fiscal note, basically. Right. Okay, Representative Bunn, welcome to committee.
Thank you, Chair Leader. Thank you, members. Members, this afternoon we're looking at a bill that is a very, very small piece of a very, very long-term project to build a new Stillwater bridge crossing over the St. Croix River between Minnesota and Wisconsin. You know, most of us are familiar with the Stillwater lift bridge. That's what this portion of this project focuses on today. I myself got out on that sunny afternoon last Saturday afternoon and took a walk by the river, viewing the lift bridge again. It's a treasure to the community. It's a treasure to the state of Minnesota, and that people want to preserve for generations to enjoy going forward. Just give you just a little context for all of this. For many, many years, there's been a struggle to replace the Stillwater lift bridge. It was built around 1930, so it has its challenges. We knew that a new bridge was required. This has been through many, many different stages. We are now in the best situation that we have been in since the 1990s to actually make this a reality. And due to the passage of House File 2800 and Chapter 152 within that, we now have moved up the progress on this bridge. It was originally intended to be funded for 2024, and as of last June, because of the work this committee and others did to pass the Comprehensive Transportation Finance Bill, this project's now been moved up to 2013. So the people of my communities and the communities along the river very much appreciate the work that's been done to move this up. So once again, we're in a better shape than we have in a long time. For the past several years, though, while we've been waiting for this additional funding and also addressing some legal issues around the bridge, progress has been moving forward throughout this time in planning for the bridge project. Funds were allocated in earlier years, federal funds and other funds, in order to develop the planning for the project, engineering design, and also for environmental mitigation around the project. What we have before you today is one little piece, one of the many mitigation projects that are required for this overall bridge crossing project to move forward. So the project right before you has to do with the Stillwater Lift Bridge and its preservation moving forward as a pedestrian and biking bridge only once the new roadway on the new Stillwater Bridge crossing has been constructed.
It's been decided through this long stakeholder process that this bridge will be preserved and that it will become a walking, biking-only bridge. This was a part of the overall memorandum of understanding and agreement around this overall project. It was part of what's required to move the project forward. In conjunction with this, a Stiller Lift Bridge Advisory Committee was formed. It has been meeting. It also had to come up with a plan for the preservation and maintenance and how to fund that. And it also has had open houses this year in January and February to get public input for that process. So again, before you is a piece of that and what this legislation does, but I will let others explain in more detail, is first of all to set up an endowment account. And this is a rather flexible endowment account. It would be a special revenue fund that could be funded from a variety of sources, federal, state, gifts from private parties, and a number of sources. Income from this endowment fund would then be used for the predictable and repetitive maintenance activities for the bridge going forward, and income derived from it would be reinvested back in the fund or used for these purposes as needed. Chair Leader, I will now let the testifiers who I brought with me, the first of whom is Todd Kartkowski from the MnDOT. This is an agency bill as part of this project. And also we're very pleased to have today with us Mayor Ken Horesky, the mayor of Stillwater as well, to make comments. After they've made their comments, I do have one very small oral amendment to make to the bill, but it'd make more sense once you've heard from them.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chairman Leader. I would like to just provide an additional...
Would you identify yourself for the record, too, please?
My name is Todd Kartkowski. I work for the Minnesota Department of Transportation in the Metro District. I'm the East Area Engineer for the Metro District. In addition to the background, some of the background information that Representative Bunn has provided, in support of the project development that has occurred to date for the St. Clair River Crossing project, as the representative identified, there was a mitigation package provided that offset the impacts that the project would have on the area's natural resources, whether they're cultural resources or the natural resources. This mitigation item that we're here today to talk about is just one of the mitigation items of that mitigation package. It does describe the lift bridge endowment account that would be established that would cover the routine operation and maintenance costs of the lift bridge after it's converted to a bicycle and pedestrian facility following the construction of the New River Crossing Bridge. The intent of the routine operation and maintenance activities were for more repetitive activities such as standard cleaning of the bridge and sweeping of the bridge, some minor repairs on the bridge, but routine operation and maintenance costs would be covered through this account. This legislation is proposed to establish the account itself. We have developed this lift bridge mitigation item through work with a number of stakeholder groups, including not only the entire stakeholder group, but also the Soil Lift Bridge Advisory Committee that the representative mentioned. Some of the other details of the legislation, I guess I would like to respond to as questions arise.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Chairman, Leader, and Representatives, I'm Ken Horesky, the Mayor of Stillwater. First, I would like to thank all of you for your past efforts in helping to advance this important river crossing that's been solved since Harry S. Truman, so we're looking forward to seeing its completion at some point in the near future. Your past help has been very appreciated. As far as this issue goes, I'd just like to stress that we are not here asking for money to fund the endowment. It's just simply to create the structure that would allow the endowment to be formed, basically create the law that would allow the endowment to be funded at a future time. So it's we're not asking for money on this. It's just simply asking that the structure or that the endowment be set up, which is a required step in the construction process. So it's a very important required step to move this project forward. Thank you.
Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this is from Mr. Kukowski, if I might, and I'm back. Oh, I'm over here. I'm fine with this bill. My question is, could you just confirm that this takes legislative action to create a special account? And the reason I'm asking is in St. Peter, we have a similar bridge. It's going to be moved the same year. Also be cutting a pedestrian bike route, it looks like. So my question is, do I have to come up in a couple of years and do the same thing, or could MnDOT have set this up without statute?
Mr. Klykowski?
Yes, Chairman and Representative. Yes, we believe this does require legislation for us to establish this endowment fund for the lift bridge, related to just the lift bridge.
Yes. That's immoral, I believe, because it's in the state treasury, too.
Okay.
I don't know if you saw that or not.
Yes.
Any further questions? Representative Dagnan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bicycles and pedestrian only, is this, how about snowmobiles, motorcycles, any chance of that? Or I've been to Stillwater many times, a beautiful city, man. But I'm trying to picture this in my mind. As we try to help some of the other groups too, I like to do both.
Mr. Klykowski, is that you're going to answer?
Chairman, Representative, the intent is for a bicycle and pedestrian use, for the lift bridge to become part of a larger loop trail system that will connect the New River Crossing up with the lift bridge. Have trails on both the Minnesota side and the Wisconsin side of the project in a loop trail system. But the intent was the users, the bicycle and pedestrians of the area.
I presume, though, too, Mr. Mayor, that's after the new bridge is built. So basically that'd be, because we just had a bill the last couple of days that did something with basically trucks.
With trucks, that is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Magnuson.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chairman Leader. Just wondering, you know, this is a state account that's being set up. Is this, do you foresee ever asking the state to put money in this account?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Klykowski?
Yes.
Or Representative Brian, either one.
Okay. Chairman, Representative. Today's the account today is just to establish the account. Both MnDOT and WISDOT have commitments in the memorandum of agreement to provide funds for the endowment account. The one of the potential funding sources of that of this account is federal funding sources.
Any further questions?
Yes, just one more.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this account going to cover the funding to make the lift bridge operation? I mean, is it going to cover that operation as well?
Mr. Klykowski.
Representative and our chairman and representative. Yes, the intent of this fund is to cover the routine operation and maintenance costs. So it would include costs, like I mentioned earlier, in addition to the tender's salary, the tender's cost. It would include costs like that to lift the bridge, the cost to lift the bridge also. Yeah.
Thank you.
Any further questions? You have another testifier, Representative Bunn?
Yes, the final testifier was having to be at another meeting and was hoping to make it, but has not yet. So this was from David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. Just because the historical side has been very involved in this process, as well as the State Office of Historical Preservation and also the historical and archaeological portions of MnDOT, because he was just going to testify in support of it. But I do, so it looks like that his organization, he told me to convey to you all, via email, he didn't make it here, that the Historical Society is very much supportive of this bill. But also the oral amendment I have is an oral amendment that came from the Historical Society, which the agency is accepting of, and I'm going to make that oral amendment on their behalf.
Probably before we have other testifiers, do you want to move, get that oral amendment moved?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The oral amendment is on line 2.10, 2.10, and it's an insertion after the words commissioner determines, insert, comma, and in consultation with the State Historic Preservation Office, comma.
That's a pretty long oral amendment.
Oh, okay.
But we'll ask Mr. Burris if he got it.
Okay. Basically saying, if in the hopefully very unlikely case that the state, for whatever reason, determines that the bridge would have to be demolished. For some reason, it became completely structurally unsound.
Representative Bunn, if we could just wait a minute till we repeat the sentence.
Mr. Chair, members, the amendment is page 2, line 10, after determines, insert, comma, in consultation with the State Historic Preservation Office, comma.
That is correct.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Any questions or comment on the oral amendment? Not all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary? The oral amendment is approved. And we did have the testimony from the Historical Society, basically. And is there any, are there any members or anyone in the audience wants to testify for or against? If not, thank you, gentlemen. And Mr. Mayor, it's good to see you again.
Thank you.
And the President Hortman isn't here to renew our motion. Representative Morrow will renew the motion.
I'll renew the motion.
And to pass the bill and return it to finance. The reason it's going back to finance is because it was sent from finance here and we have to return it back there. So unless there are any questions, all in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Contrary. House file 1221 passed and will be returned to the finance committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member.
Representative Atkins. Representative Erdahl, you want to be with here, I thought. So.
Yeah, he told me about that.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. I'll move that House File 810 be before the committee.
Thank you.
Representative Erdahl. You're getting pretty classy up here, if that's true.
I'm delving into the world of technology for the first time, so bear with me a little bit. And Mr. Chairman, appreciate your admonition earlier. Most of the people behind me do have signs that say Little Crow, Transylvania, and I asked them not to not to wave them. Most of you at one time or another, somewhere during the last session or two, have heard the word Little Crow line. And so I, other than my little and it's a short audiovisual here. I won't get into too much detail. Just why is this needed? Basically, I've discovered over the years that there didn't seem to be any real future in-depth plan for Western Minnesota. For the if you go again from the Twin Cities to Fargo on 94 or to the southwest on 169, there's that quadrant in between, basically Highway 12 out toward Wilmer, where there doesn't seem to be much of a real future vision as far as transportation. Now we have a lot of people out there who work in the Twin Cities. 62% of the people of Meeker County, of the workers, leave there each day to work out of the county, and most of them go to the Twin Cities to work. So I have a lot of people using Highway 12, which if you've traveled it much, is just say it has challenges as a highway. So what we're looking for is a study of the feasibility of transit, what type of transit for Western Minnesota, basically from Minneapolis at this point to Wilmer. And so with that, if I can work my PowerPoint here.
All right, get me started, somebody. Oh, going.
Members, you do have in your packet also.
Is that the first one? Okay, please put it back to me. All right, I got it now. All right, Rowan in northern Santa Fe, parallels State Highway 12, the former Great Northern Empire Builder route. I once took it from Litchfield to Seattle in 1961. Here is the Wayzata Depot. Senator Bonner, who is promoting this in the Senate, wanted to make sure we had the Wayzata Depot. A logical choice for a transitway. Passenger service was discontinued in 1977 when Amtrak made changes in the rail service route. The western route, statewide passenger system, complements other lines. The North Star, Duluth, Red Rock. There again is substantial growth west of Minneapolis. Wilmer is an important regional center. It will help to relieve congestion on I-294 and Highway 12. Recommended for future passenger service expansion by the American Association of State Highway Safety Transportation Officials and Amtrak. The roadbed is in good condition, will not have to be rebuilt. There currently is a freight rail service of 60 miles an hour, and not always heavily used for freight routes, although it is seasonal, but there are 9 trains daily. So we don't need a lot of changes out here. Additional passenger siding, stations, changes in signaling to accommodate faster passenger trains, a maintenance facility. I think we want to study this, we want to look more at it, but I think there's some real opportunities in the future. Amtrak operation opportunity, the rail line is the current freight line. Amtrak is authorized to operate passenger service on freight rail lines. California and North Carolina have bought the equipment and Amtrak operates the service. I don't know if we need to look at these maps so much, but there is one map that we skipped over that I have to go back to. And that's this one. This is the basic route that we would follow through Representative Deputy's district. Right about here, the sun shines more brightly as we get Representative Emmer's district. Here comes Howard Lake, my district here. We could stop off here and give you the greatest ball of twine, the biggest ball of twine ever made by one man. Ooh. All right. Move right along. Of course, Litchfield is here. And you know, if we ever did a new Viking stadium right here, we have a Darwin flat. People could get out there quick. Right here is another project, the Greenleaf State Recreation Area. People could get to that. Grove City, my home right here, and Wilmer. So with that, my nod to technology maybe gave you a little better idea of what I'm talking about. I'd like to bring up Mr. Qualley.
Were there any questions, Representative Holmberg?
While we're doing that, have you been informed that this rail line is not going to be part of the statewide rail study without this legislation?
No.
No further questions? Representative, Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, committee members, thank you very much. I'm Philip Qualley with the United Transportation Union. We do have a handout in your packet today which has some information regarding passenger service in America today, March 26th, as well as some historical documents, including timetables from prior Amtrak service and Great Northern service, 1967 and 1975, for your review, which shows service in the Little Coral Corridor. And with that, we'd simply like to say, on behalf of our membership, we support the Little Crow's efforts as well as other corridors in the state. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions to Mr. Pauley, Representative Dupke?
Thank you, Representative Leader. I wanted to ask, I know that it goes through Lysetta, and I know you've been working with Terry Bonhoeff or talking to Senator Bonhoeff on this. Did you, have you talked to the mayor of the town particularly, and I'm sorry, Representative Lysetta, have you talked to the mayor of Lysetta or any of the people in that to see if they want to have a train going through? There's, it's a resident, there's part of it is a residential district as well, and I just wanted to know if there's any communication with the mayor in that area.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Deputy. Our next step, and we've talked about this, is bringing together the various political officials and entities along the line and have a meeting and talk to them. We have to build a coalition. There has to be widespread support among the people along the line, or you can't do it anyway. So, yes, that's in the plan.
Thank you very much.
Rip and Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I attended last Friday's first meeting of the policy part of the state rail plan process. That brought together the consultants at MnDOT's hired, MnDOT itself, rail, folks from the railroads, folks from the counties and the like. This is a good process. They're going to develop a state rail plan by the end of the year with a report. And all the documents, in fact, are online. Anyone in Minnesota will be able to watch the progress of this state planning process for freight and passenger rail. I know that the Little Crow was mentioned at this meeting. Senator Bonhoeff got up and made sure that we all knew about the Little Crow line. And I would hope that we allow MnDOT to now move forward and do a complete state rail plan using the expertise that MnDOT has brought on board to complete this process.
Any further questions? Representative Erdahl, what's...
There's an amendment now.
Representative Erdahl has Amendment 808. Is someone going to move the amendment, Representative Moore?
Well, sure, Mr. Chair. I'll move the amendment, the DE1 amendment.
The amendment's before us. Any questions or comment? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary. The amendment is adopted. Do you want to explain?
Sure. The purpose of, well, I historically, what I wanted to do was to get this into the state transportation plan that is actually reaching a conclusion. It's probably too late for what I was trying to do. Because I wanted to look at more than just rail. I wanted to look at buses. I wanted to look at, you know, other commuter options that still may be out there and still need to be looked at. And I have been talking with MnDOT about what can be done to include some of these types of studies in there as well. But due to the fact that that phase of the plan is reaching a conclusion, it seemed more practical to move to the state freight and transportation plan and put it into there, which then would be folded eventually into the statewide transportation plan. And yes, Representative Holberg, I do expect that this will be done by, that it will be included into the plan. But I just wanted to take this opportunity to comment a little bit of the frustration that I felt when I went to the forum on this plan, the state transportation plan in Wilmer, which focused me a little bit more on this, and to see that the, basically for that east-west route from Minneapolis to Wilmer, there was, again, very little vision, very little planning. This is an important artery to the west. This is a vital corridor. Actually, it's listed as an emergency route from Minneapolis. And if you traveled it at any time when there's much traffic on it, it'd be an emergency to get out of here. You know, they identified Highway 23, a north-south route, but again, not the east-west route. Frankly, a lot more people want to come from Litchfield and Wilmer to the Twin Cities than from Marshall to St. Cloud. So with that, I appreciate your time today. I wanted
for more visibility to raise the vitality of this. And appreciate this amendment being added. But at this time, I ask the chairman respectfully if you would lay over the bill.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. House File 810 will be laid over, or laid on the table, basically. Thank you, testifiers.
Thank you very much.
The next bill up is Representative Atkins in the audience.
Yeah.
Representative Reiner, are you ready to go?
Yeah.
We've got one thing we can take. It's just a minute. We can take. We can. Someone looked at the minutes. We can check the minutes. Representative Holberg moved the minutes of whatever date it was. March 19th. Any questions or additions or corrections? Not all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary. Minutes are adopted. We also can move on the reconsider the action we had on March 19th with Representative Detmer on House File 672. This bill was referred to us from the Finance Committee, and we didn't. What did we get? Was that a referred back?
It wasn't.
Okay. We actually referred this bill to the Finance Committee. It doesn't have to go to the Finance Committee. It can go directly to the floor, and that's the action. So we have two votes to take. We actually have to recall it, or basically, recall the action which was on March 19th to bring it back to our committee. Any discussion on that motion? Representative Beard, okay.
I was just going to make the motion if you had.
Yeah, okay. Any questions or comments? Not all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary. The motion's adopted. Now we have to move to send the bill to House File 672 to the General Register. Representative Beard makes that motion.
I do.
Any questions? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. House File 672 is passed and will be sent, placed on the General Register. Now do we have Representative Atkins in the audience or not? Representative Detmer? Detmer?
No.
Or no,
I'm
not.
Reiner.
Reiner. And Representative Reiner, when you're coming here, we'll give you 1.5 hour for all your testifiers and your bills. If that doesn't happen, if it isn't finished, we will lay it on the table or move to pass whatever happens. But we're not going to run, because we can have a lot of testifiers. I think we have a number of testifiers the way it is.
I've got three, Mr. Chair.
So we're by 5:45, we'll be pulling. We'll be doing something with the bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1005 be recommended as Pat and passed and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, there is a DE3 amendment, and I thought, Mr. Chair, we might as well take that first. With Mr. Burris's help, we reorganized the language that was sent to me from the Senate, and I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you want, Mr. Burris might take a minute just to walk through some of the highlights of the work you did on it. I think it makes a lot more sense, and it's easier to understand in Mr. Burris's form.
Okay, we can
try to move to the
DE3 amendment. The D3, or DE3 amendment is before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary. The amendment is adopted. Do you want Representative Reiner, do you want Mr. Burris to speak?
If you would, just maybe hit the brief highlights.
Mr. Chair and members, a number of the provisions are the same between the amendment and the original bill. I would highlight a couple of items. The first is Section 1 of the amendment, as well as Section 2. These go to definitions and help to establish that enhanced driver's licenses, along with enhanced provisional licenses and enhanced instruction permits, operate and would work the same way as a current law driver's license, instruction permit, and provisional license. In particular, the language was added on 1.20 to 1.23, establishing that enhanced driver's licenses work essentially as a subset of a typical driver's license. Another change with the amendments is in section 7, and this is actually incorporates an amendment that was made in the Senate to specify particular fees for each of the types of enhanced licenses. There are a couple of provisions that are not in the amendment that were in the original bill. They've been removed because, in my opinion, they're made unnecessary by some of the other changes made in the delete all. By taking the approach that an enhanced driver's license is a subset of a typical driver's license, a couple of the provisions that essentially tried to establish that same thing became no longer necessary. On page 2 of the amendment, in section 4, there is a couple of changes. The essence is moving from substantive language that was in the original bill to be a standalone provision, so that the definition of enhanced driver's license doesn't contain substantive information, that's actually in a standalone provision instead. And there's some clarification that the enhanced driver's license work both in the same manner as current law driver's licenses, as well as for the purposes of entering the United States upon approval by the Department of Homeland Security. That same clarification is made for identification cards, also on page 2, as well as on page 6, section 10. Again, it's a slight change in language, just clarifying that the way that the enhanced identification card works is to provide for entering the Department of Homeland Security. Mr. Chair, I think those are the primary changes with the delete all amendments.
Thank you. Maybe Mr. Reinert, or Representative Reinert, maybe you want to explain the general purpose of the bill.
Yep, I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the House File 1005 creates an enhanced driver's license that denotes citizenship. It contains technology and security features approved by the Department of Homeland Security. Why are we looking at a concept like this? The federal government recently passed the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative, which requires a passport and other federally approved ID or proof of citizenship in order to cross the border. The goal is to preserve travel, trade, and cultural ties between Minnesota and our northern neighbors while providing increased security at the borders. Some examples would be farmers delivering goods across the border. A great example is International Falls in Fort Francis, where people travel back and forth across the border. The movie theaters in Fort Francis, the curling clubs in Fort Francis, the shopping mall is in I-Falls. Hunters and fishermen that want to go north, do flying trips, things like that, are much more likely to have a driver's license on them than a passport card or a passport. So what exactly is the EDL? First of all, it's completely voluntary, and I know this is a point that's been confused. I spent most of my last day or two trying to share that with people. An applicant would pay an extra $15 with proof of citizenship to get an EDL. Only U.S. citizens who are Minnesota residents would be eligible for the Minnesota EDL. It is a cheaper alternative than getting a passport, which runs $100+. The EDL would be embedded in the license, and it would also include radio frequency identification. And this is probably members the most controversial part of the proposal. This RFID will validate proof of citizenship. The tag embedded in the card will contain no personal information, just a unique reference number which indicates proof of citizenship only. It does not have a power source. It cannot transmit data. How does it work? At a border crossing, the RFID reader uses electromagnetic waves to energize the tag on the EDL and collect the reference number. The reader converts the radio waves reflected back from the RFID tag into digital information, transmits it to the Customs and Border Protection Network. There's data encryption, security networks, and firewalls to protect the information while it's being transmitted. The reference number is then compared to U.S. records to verify that the identity of the individual matches the information on the EDL. So what is this not? The enhanced driver's license is not EOID. Like the folks, I didn't know what EOID was until I got here and agreed to work on this, but was informed quickly. The ACLU has sent an email indicating that they reviewed the language and their national office has reviewed the language and that they say it is not EOID. So does anybody else see this? Currently, Washington, Vermont, and New York have already adopted EDLs. Arizona, Michigan, North Dakota, and Texas are seriously looking at similar legislation. On our Canadian side, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, and Quebec have already enacted EDLs. Five other provinces are considering the idea, and the three that aren't don't share a border with us. So that's it in a nutshell, members. I've asked Tony Russo from the Office of Trade to say a few words about the importance of our commerce with our northern neighbors. John Edmond from the Office of Minnesota Tourism is here to say a few words about the importance of tourist trade. And we haven't quite tracked him down yet, but if we do, Jeremy Estenson from the Minnesota Chamber is going to say a few words about their support as well. So,
are there any questions before the testifiers? Representative Jeff King.
Thank you, Representative Leader. This bill has generated a lot of emails in my mailbox. And Representative Ryder, you said you just learned what a real ID is, and maybe you can educate me on this. But let me just read you a part of only one of the emails that was sent to me, and it says, "Can you imagine if the bill passes? We all have an RFID chip in our driver's licenses. We keep those in our pockets at nearly all times. This would allow the state to place sensors under bridges, streetlights, entryways of government buildings. You can get this. Will include the bank you go to every week. It would enable someone to read the ID number at a distance and send this information back to a computer. Although you said there was no electronic, but it seems to me." He likened it to 1984. Mm-hmm. Now, please give me a little bit more comfort. Yep. I appreciate it.
I've gotten those emails all day, too.
Representative Reiner,
I
think we'll hold the questions. You respond to this one because I'm sure that's a big question. We'll hold the other question, but if you respond to that, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Ducky. I've gotten those emails all day long, too. I responded to everyone who's written me, none of them have been from my district, which is a little surprising. My district is a district that leans libertarian, and members, as you can see, you'll see that streak is in me as well. And as most of you know, I'm a Navy reservist, and I didn't sign up to give away our individual freedoms, I signed up to protect them. So I wouldn't be carrying this if I thought that it did otherwise. First of all, again, it's voluntary. You know, frankly, I won't get one of these. 99% of people in my district won't get one of these. We don't cross the border enough to make it worthwhile. But for the folks along our northern border with Canada that do and cross daily or sometimes more than once daily, this is actually a critical part of keeping commerce flowing as well as tourism flowing. So that, in short, is the explanation I've been sharing with folks that have been writing to me. If you have concerns, just don't get one. It's not mandatory. It's not being required. It's just that something we're doing voluntarily for a part of our population that does live along the Canadian border.
Just one final question, and this is going to replace a passport or citizenship information, is that correct? That's all that's going to be on there? Is there a problem getting passports and proof of citizenship of with people along the border? Is that why they don't want to carry it with them? Because they would have to carry this too.
Mr. Chair, two responses. Number one, it is timely and costly, but number two, it's just physically carrying two separate things that you may or may not always remember to have with you. So it is, frankly, a convenience that folks can have one item that is a driver's license / proof of citizenship.
Thank you, Representative Reiner.
Thank you for the question.
Perhaps your testifiers.
Mr. Chair, we'll start with Mr. Russo from the Minnesota Trade Office.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tony LaRusso. I'm the Executive Director of the State of Minnesota Trade Office, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. The Minnesota Trade Office and Department of Employment and Economic Development does not actually have a position on enhanced driver's license, but generally we're supportive of any initiative that ensures the free flow of goods, services, people, and capital across our border, yet balances our need for border integrity and national security. We leave it to the state and federal public safety and security officials to determine whether the enhanced driver's license actually meets those requirements. What I can speak to is the incredible importance of maintaining our relationship with Canada. And I'll quickly go through some of these slides. I'll make it quick. As you likely know, Minnesota has a Canadian consulate here. We actually have only two foreign consulates officially in Minnesota with diplomatic representation, Canada and Mexico. The Norwegians maintain a relationship here as well, but it's not with diplomatic representation. I'll leave tourism to my colleague from Explore Minnesota to speak to that in greater detail. But from a sister city relationship, we have three sister city relationships in Minnesota with Canada, Minneapolis with Winnipeg, Duluth with Thunder Bay, and Little Canada with Thunder Bay. From a trade and investment perspective, there are nearly 100 Canadian companies with major investments in Minnesota and approximately 50 Minnesota firms that have operations in Canada. And that doesn't speak to the hundreds or not thousands of Minnesota small to medium-sized companies that have trade relationships with Canada as well. Some of the larger companies, of course, 3M, Cargill, Medtronic, Best Buy, and others. Our exports to Canada are a significant part of our state export strategy. About 25% of our exports go to Canada, and we see significant growth in our market there. Even though it is an established and mature market, we continue to see significant growth. We don't have the final numbers for 2008, so looking at 2007, the growth was 21% between 2006 and 2007. I don't expect that in today's economic environment we're going to continue to see that same level of growth in 2008 when those numbers come out. But nonetheless, it's still a growing market for our state. Again, 25% of our exports go to Canada. China is our number two trading partner, and the remainder of our top 10 partners are listed on a slide. We have an extensive array of exports to Canada, a lot of vehicle transportation-related exports, of course, to Canada. The four trucks are important. The two provinces that we trade with the most, not surprisingly, are the two provinces that we share a border with, Ontario and Manitoba. From an import perspective, we actually import about $11 billion of goods from Canada. So we actually import more than twice than what we export. Our primary import from Canada happens to be petroleum, and primarily from Alberta. There are six border crossings, and approximately 90% of our shipments to Canada happen by truck across those borders. The most active borders are Grand Portage and International Falls. So again, from a trade perspective, Minnesota has a very strong and active relationship with Canada, and it's very important that we maintain that free flow of goods and border goods and services across the border. So whether that's enhanced driver's license or whether that's passports, we don't actually have a position on that as long as we maintain that strong relationship with our Canadian partner to the north.
Questions for Mr. LaRusso? Not, thank you. Mr. Estenson.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for having me. Jeremy Estenson, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Here today to support Representative Reinert's bill. We just think it is a great alternative for businesses that are either border businesses, trucking companies, or folks who just have to cross the borders on a regular basis to having to carry a passport and or birth certificate. And I believe the cost is $15 for the enhanced driver's license as opposed to the cost of a passport, which I don't even know what that is, but I know it's more than $15. So we just think it's a great alternative. We appreciate the voluntary aspect and look forward to working with the author to move the bill along.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Estenson.
Mr. Chair, my last testifier members, I will note that Pat McCormick from DDS is in the audience to answer technical questions, but my last testifier is John Edmond from the Director of Explore Minnesota.
Okay. Mr. Edmond?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. My name is John Edmond. I'm Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism, and I'll be relatively brief. I just want to comment about this legislation as it relates to tourism in Minnesota. It's critical that we have a free flow of travel between our borders with Canada and Minnesota. Tourism is a huge industry in the state, It's an $11 billion industry, represents over 244,000 jobs. Put it in another perspective, over 15% of all the state sales tax in Minnesota comes from the leisure and hospitality industry, about 10% of the total employment. And because Canada is so important to Minnesota, we've seen, as Tony mentioned, a great increase in travel from Canada over the recent years. Travelers come to Minnesota from Canada to do shopping, to do outdoors, to visit our cities and destinations. And it's very important. While border security is also important, so is the free flow of travel. And just one other point to mention is that this driver's license enhancement bill does impact travel from Minnesota to Canada. It does not impact travel from Canada to Minnesota, but as we've just learned, there have been counter measures on the part of the two provinces of Ontario and Manitoba. And my bottom line goal in speaking out on behalf of this is that tourism is important to the state, and anything we can do to continue the free flow of travel benefits everyone in Minnesota.
Any questions? Representative Dusty.
Thank you, Chairman Miller. I have one more question for you. Thank you. I noticed that there is a fiscal note, but it is a saving of, is it $200,000 or $200,000 a year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dusty, it's a little over $213,000. It's actually generated because of the additional fee that goes with the voluntary license.
I'm sorry, could you explain that to me again? With the additional fee?
But actually, because there's a voluntary, the license is voluntary, it comes with an additional $15 fee above and beyond your driver's license, so that actually generates money.
Now, as far as the, Chairman Meade, may I ask one more question? Thank you very much. Is there extra technology that needs to be purchased in order to accommodate this new license as well?
Representative Dutton, Mr. Chair Weaver, I think that's probably something that Pat McCormick from DBS could answer best.
Thank you.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Pat McCormick from Driver and Vehicle Services. The fiscal note, I don't have it right in front of me, but on the House side. The fiscal note, the first year, talks about the fact that there would be programming changes as well as changes to the card itself that would need to be made. And so those costs would be charged in that in the first year. But then in the second year, as you can see, there are additional, if we're correct in assuming how many licenses we were planning on, which I think if I'm not mistaken, we were talking about, I was going to say a 1,000 cars the first year. I'm not seeing it on here, but then we're looking at a savings in the second year, so you would recoup the money that you needed to spend in the first year of the biennium. So within the biennium, you would recoup the money. Now, as most of you know, and I'll just remind all the committee members that DVS has a fee-based budget, and every biennium before we submit our budget proposal, we reassess our fees and look at our costs and as such. So while we're estimating, based on what other states have done that have implemented this card, it's been about a $15 increase in the fees. If at that time we would find that our costs are paid for and we don't need to charge that much for this license, then we would be requesting less of a charge for this license. So we are showing you, though, that it looks, if our numbers are correct, that we may be able to recoup our costs and we may be able to look at lowering that fee in the next biennium. But as I'm saying this, I can't, you know, we'll just have to wait and see what the card costs would be associated with it and how many people really want this card, because it is a voluntary card.
So. Other questions?
I did have another part to my question. That was, do we need to purchase any additional technology or people to monitor the border crossings with this electronic card?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the the Department of Homeland Security and the Border Patrol would do have this technology that would be used for this RFID chip that's added to the card. And it is just a random number that's selected when these cards are manufactured. Every state has their own contract with a card vendor, because every state has authority to issue their own driver's licenses. So it would just be an amendment to the contract that the state would already have with a card vendor that we'd be talking about. The department would first need to, if this bill became law, the department and the state have to negotiate an agreement, the Department of with the Department of Homeland Security, and then the details are worked out. We'd have to present what we would like our card to look like, and get agreement with them that it meets their federal regulations about what you need to have in this enhanced driver's license. And so we would do that as part of the process, the technology. And our estimates are that most states are charging about $15 extra for a driver's license that has this technology, and that takes care of the additional costs that you have in implementing this.
You have a further question?
Thank you, Representative Leader. I do have a question, because you mentioned something that the federal government requires the information that is to be put on the card. Could you tell us what information? Because I know we just heard Representative Reinert say that there was going to be no personal information on this card. Does the federal language require personal information on this card?
Mr. Chair and Representative, what I meant to say is that any additional, every driver's license has personal information on it. This is a regular driver's license, but it does have this RFID chip on it so that you can go right through at the border crossing. They have computers that pick it up. You have to just show your license and you go through. But every license has private information on it. The only thing, there would be nothing private on that RFID chip. All it is a random number. What happens is the Department of Homeland Security, my understanding is, authorizes so many numbers that our card vendor would be able to use. They're random numbers. Those go to the card vendor, who would work with us and make sure we're matching up enough. If that person wants a license, we're not choosing who gets that number. It's just a chip that's added to the card. All that means is, as they're driving through, that number on that chip is a number that they have in their system, so that they know you have an authentic enhanced driver's license, that you've met the requirements, that you are a citizen, which you do in our driver license processing, unless you have legal presence through immigration. Those are the two ways that you are allowed to get a driver's license. You either have to be a U.S. citizen or a permanent or temporary resident of the United States. So if you'd have to be a citizen, we would have already authorized that in our regular application process. You're not working with the Department of Homeland Security, you're working with our state. So it shouldn't be anything that would be different than the normal process, other than the card has a different header and has this chip in it.
We're getting pretty close, and we need some...
Thank you, Chairman.
Representative Magnus.
Just quickly, Mr. Chairman. Representative Reinert, how many states... I think you started out saying there were other states that have this. Could you run that by me again? I didn't catch the number.
Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Magnus, there are three that already have it: Washington, Vermont, New York, and there are five that are looking at it. They're basically at the same stage we are: Arizona, Michigan, North Dakota, and Texas.
And Mr. Chairman, those are volunteer similar programs is what you're proposing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes. Thank you.
Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two areas that I'm concerned with, and both one of them goes to the language on page 6, lines 21 to 22, saying that the driver's license must include the best available anti-counterfeit laminate technology. What happens if that's updated every 6 months? Or, I mean, that language just seems to me to have good intentions, but could be disastrous consequences if, in fact, that laminate technology is updated on a frequent basis. So if the bill moves forward, I think you should look at some different language so that the upgrading of technology doesn't drive how often you have to update the kind of driver's license you have. But more importantly, will the Department of Homeland Security have the information on the individual at their fingertips? In other words, you say that there's nothing contained with the number. You're going to get this number, and so you flash with some kind of machine, and that number is going to come up. Well, I'm assuming that in order for it to be of any value, Homeland Security will have to, through that number, have a picture, a name, an age, etc. Is that correct in how this works?
You know that, Ms. McDonald?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, my recollection, I'm going to have to go back and verify and then get back to the committee. My recollection is that our Border Patrol, which is part of our state Border Patrol, I think are allowed access to our database with certain, not with every part of information, but I think that if there was a question, it would be, they would have to access that information. It's not that the Homeland Security has it. I think it's more the Border Patrol that we have in our state that have that information. But I'll have to verify it and get back with you.
And
I know that I'm pretty sure we have an agreement with which we do it with most law enforcement officials anyway, that we allow certain information on driver's licenses.
And Mr. Chair, I know you want to move along, and I understand this is going to civil, and some of this is kind of getting into the civil realm. But what my concerns, and if this moves to civil, I would hope that Representative Reinhart, you'd have a lot of information around who collects what information. Will there be a log somewhere that will be able to, according to a number, track how many times the person entered, when they came in and out, et cetera? I mean, I think there's some big government issues here, and that goes all along with what kind of data is shared with who, for what purposes, how long is it held, who can it be shared with. All of those kinds of elements, I think, make people really nervous, and I'm not so sure that the answers are available here to us today. And then the other question, and also it can fall definitely into a civil law kind of issue, is who would be responsible in the case of a breach of the security of this information, or, you know, who's ultimately liable if there's unintended consequences, be it with being part of this type of database? Who's responsible? I don't see any language in here about that. And then the technology of this radio frequency identification technology, is that available in the private sector, and could, in fact, the concerns about being tracked, whether you're at the bank or other places, is that a valid concern or not? And if so, would an individual be able to have the opportunity to have, say, two driver's licenses, one for everyday use that they would carry with them that wouldn't have the quote-unquote tracking device in it, and another one that if they were going to use this type of expedited border crossing type process that they could carry for that purpose? So those would be my questions, and we don't have to waste a lot of time.
Actually,
now,
this bill is going to civil law or civil justice, but if you want to have a quick response, Representative Reiner or Ms. McDonald.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, I just want to make it clear that this is only the state's driver license data. That's the total difference why there are so many border states that are using this versus real ID, and why those states have have decided to use it, especially the ones bordering Canada and Mexico. It would be under our authority to be able to release any data, and they would do. The only people that might have access would be Border Patrol, and I think they would only have a certain amount of access. But I will verify that, and I certainly think that's worthwhile to put in the legislation at some point, that we could mention it's under Chapter 13 and under our provisions and our authority, so that obviously we would have the authority in terms of who would receive that data. But I've talked to many of the administrators of these states that have it, and that has not been an issue in any of those states.
Well, and Mr. Chair, real briefly, I'm not concerned about the age, height, weight data. I mean, that the government holds that data. What I'm really concerned about is John Doe left the United States on such and such day at this crossing, and then 2 days later crossed here, and then all of a sudden somebody says, oh, well, we're looking for people that fit a certain profile or behavioral criteria. Oh, let's use the data that we collected at the border crossings so that we can look for people that meet these kinds of criteria, because we're going to profile them or investigate them for a particular type of activity. That's what I'm getting at.
Thank you. Representative Rainer,
yep.
I think basically, as I was watching the clock, we had roughly 10 minutes of poll testify. The rest is basically questions. So we'll give, I think there's some opponents,
sure.
Apparently we'll give them some time and for 10 minutes and that's it.
Right, and I've got brief closing comments for the end, Mr. Chair.
Right. But we'd like to get it. We have two more bills. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mitch.
Because we're going to have whatever testimony it is in that time, that's it.
Mr. Chair, members, excuse if I'm a little jolty. I've been up for about 24 hours reviewing over 5,000 pages of Department of Homeland Security documents, and I can answer the majority of your questions today.
Well, before you do that, what's your status? Are you just an ordinary, are you with
the... First of all, I'm not a global citizen. I'm a citizen of the United States.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, are you a law enforcement or something that you...
I'm an elected official. I was recently elected supervisor of the Ramsey Conservation District.
Okay.
So, first of all, what alarms me is that many didn't know what the Real ID Act was. Well, let me just briefly catch you up to speed. The Real ID Act was originally adapted from recommendations from the 9/11 Commission for nationalized ID standards. The bill was originally defeated, however, in Congress. However, it was an attached to military/tsunami relief bill in 2005. Therefore, it passed without any debate. Implementation of that on a national level has been extended to 2011, and it does stand. RFID technology is included in those requirements. So what this is essentially jumping that forward. Granted, it is voluntary, but what is alarming is that it's even being, you know, implemented. Let me go through some of the Homeland Security documents to catch you up to speed. First of all, and these can all be found on Homeland Security's website. First is a quote from about 5,500 pages of documents on Homeland Security on this issue. Quote, the states are exploring the alternative of using the commercial driver's license information system as a platform supporting the state-to-state data exchange. Real ID implements a national data system so that all the states will combine driver's license information, including driver history, state by state on a level so that local law enforcement can access that across the board. CDLIS already supports queries to every state driver's license vehicle bureau every time an individual applies for a driver's license in any state or the District of Columbia. So that means this information system has all of our driver's license information. Further, it is more technically and economically difficult to design a state-by-state data exchange that avoids using a central repository to direct the checks to the appropriate state. So basically what Department of Homeland Security is saying is we want to keep this in place because it has all of our information. Further, Department of Homeland Security supports limiting access to the data verification system to authorize state DMV personnel, and this is the kicker, federal government agencies engaged in official responsibilities pertaining to law enforcement. That could be CIA, FBI, NSA, whatever. So, in Section 7209 of the Intelligence Reform and Terrorist Prevention Act, further, in addition, enhanced driver's license will include technologies that facilitate electronic verification and legitimate movement of travelers through land and sea ports of entry. So, yes, they will know where we're going. That's what this is designed for. Comment. Many commentators said RFID technology should not be used in real IDs. There are significant privacy and security risks. Noted that the Department of Homeland Security Data and Privacy Integration Advisory Committee and the Government Accountability Office both advised against using RFID technology. The response from Homeland Security. The use of RFID technology is essential in order to ensure facilitation at crowded U.S. land and sea crossing points. That's pretty scary that they use the word facilitation of citizens passing in and out of the country. It's scary language. Further, Lockheed Martin, this comes from an article, March 28, 2008. Lockheed Martin uses RFID technology to track stealth fighters. Defense contractor Lockheed Martin has asked its suppliers to provide parts and materials for the new Joint Strike Fighter aircraft to include RFID labels on the shipments by the end of the year.
Further, if I may just interrupt, if you can avoid a lot of repetition on it, wrap up if you have another testifier there. Your time is running.
I apologize. In order to get a picture as to, to what's all this doing, this is
good.
Essential to answering your questions. Furthermore, so basically, Lockheed Martin is the big promoter of this particular RFID chip. And right now they're using the chip to track the parts of the newest and latest stealth fighter all across the country. Furthermore, right now there is an information center located in Virginia where Lockheed Martin, it's called the Lighthouse, tracks all Department of Defense transportation. So if there's a shipment of M16s going from the factory to a plant, there's an RFID chip on there. It's a huge room, and you can look this up, that has big plasma screens all over the place and little dots tracking everything. So this is military technology they're talking about here, using to track just simple shipments that they want to implement into these IDs. And the critical thing about it is that if you look inside of this legislation, it says randomly assigned number, but yet we heard testimony from representatives who said that this can prove citizenship. Well, what is that? That's your name, and in the bill itself it says it's your social security number. So this is the alarming point, is that here we know that the federal government has this data, okay? We know that with RFID technology, the federal government can track shipments all across the country, and they want to implement this into driver's license. That is very scary, coming from a federal government that has just recently warrantless wiretapping. NSA agents saying that all communications in the United States have been tracked.
We should do that. This
is very, very critical, members. This technology, I can go more into this and it gets even scarier, but this is the military-industrial complex implemented on RIDs, and if you look into Real ID, which is going to be into effect in 2011, everybody's going to have to carry these things. If you want to go into a federal building, if you want to go in and out of our country.
I appreciate that, but everybody is voluntary. Walmart, I understand, I'm not for or against. Walmart has it on their shipments already. That UPS has got it, and I think we're...
You're human beings.
It might be difficult. There's another testifier. We're going to cut you off in about 3 minutes because we've already gone way over what we had in the conference. Are you Mr. Quaidy or Mr. Eric?
I'm Mr. Irish.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representatives. You know, I find it quite alarming myself that this is actually being, you know, represented to you folks as, you know, it's part of the Homeland Security, but it's not part of the Homeland. If we all listen as I was back here, I heard very clearly that this would be monitored by the Homeland Security, and then, it's not going to be, it's just going to be by our Border Patrol. You know, it sounds too wishy-washy, it needs to be rewritten and well-directed, and I'm totally against this. I'm a 37-year-old man. I'm a single father of the sole custody of a 14-year-old girl I've had for 9 years. And Secretary of Homeland Security states that if I don't get this, you know, enhanced driver's license, I would be considered a terrorist. I've read the law. I've been on the Secretary of Homeland Security. I've read the legislative that this gentleman's talking about. Every bit that he's saying is true. It's written in law. And how they mask it to make it okay for state to state to take this on as a voluntary, it is demanded by 2011 in May that every state in the United States has to adapt to this enhanced driver's license. So as it is now, it's voluntary, but this is the first step. If we allow this to happen, the next step is mandatory. And this identification number that we're all going to be tagged with, I have a birth certificate. I have a social security number. What else do I need to prove that I'm a citizen? I'm not a terrorist. We're not strapping bombs to our children to go out here and blow up bus stations. We're America. We live in a great, free country. And this is an invasion of privacy, and it's unconstitutional. At any point, when you have to go to cross that border to get this, like you said, it's voluntary right now, but if you read the Secretary of Homeland Security's position on this, it will be mandatory by 2011, and this is just the beginning stages of it. And I'm opposed to it. Like I said, I've not needed to be tracked for 37 years, and neither have any one of you sitting at that, you know, on the board right now. Why? My question is why? Why do we need this? It's ridiculous. It's just another, and how much money is the state actually going to spend on this? Do we actually have enough money right now to keep spending on driver's license? Did we not just get a new driver's license? Did we not just approve a brand new driver's license that we got? This one right here? This was just done, what, 2-3 years ago? Now we're going to spend more money on a new one? Come on. I just spent mine getting it renewed. If this bill's passed, now I'm going to have to go get another one if it's voluntary, if I want to go past the border of Canada. What if I want to fly to Europe? Am I going to need this car to fly to Europe? Or is this just for the great Canada?
Could you wrap up if you got any conclusions?
Like I said, you know, I just think it's unconstitutional. It's an invasion of my privacy. I should be able to go anywhere in the world I want without being tracked or having a data number attached to my name.
Yeah, thank you. There'll be no clapping or we'll clear the room or we'll reset.
I am 14 years old, and in 2 years I should be getting my driver's license. I feel that I do not have to be tracked, and I'm pretty sure all my friends do too. The only person who needs to know where I am at every moment is my dad until I turn 18 and able to live by myself.
Okay, thank you. Representative Reinhart, we're ready to whatever your wishes are. We've had testimony equal time, basically, on both opinions.
I don't have any further comments, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to make closing comments, or you want to... Who made the motion, Representative Wong? Did you make the motion?
I did. I did, Mr. Chair.
Oh, that's right, you did. You want to renew your motion?
I renew my motion to that House File 1005 be recommended and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice.
Civil Justice, right. Any further questions?
I think there's a lot of issues still here. Is your motion to pass or without recommendation?
My original motion was to pass with recommendation.
It's going to Civil Justice Committee, Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair, I know that. I just want to know if it was with a recommendation to pass or without recommendation, so I know how he's going to vote on it.
your recommendation to pass, is that what you refer to? That's what you're
hoping
to do. Any further questions? If not, all representatives, Reinhardt made a motion that House File 1005 be recommended to pass and sent to the Civil Justice Committee. Recommended to pass, right. As amended, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions, comments? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary?
No.
No.
The amendment 1005 passed and will be sent to the Civil Justice Committee. That's amended, actually. Is Representative Atkins in here? Oh, there he is.
Captain Ruth Chair.
You've been hard to find. Did we? Representative Atkins. You have someone who's going to make a motion on your bill, or should I move it? Sarah, move House File 103 before the committee. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This may well be the most boring bill you have this afternoon. The bill itself, I'll give you a brief explanation, and then the purpose for being in front of the committee is very, very specific. But the bill lifts the cap on claims for folks that have, the best example is the 35W collapse that we had a year ago. We made all those families go through hearing after hearing after hearing while they awaited us to make an appropriation to be put into a victim's fund. This does away with that cap relative to the number of people that can make claims. And the reason for that is, you know, when you measure the two things against one another and you just talk purely about accountability, if we are at fault, do we want to limit the amount that folks can recover from the state and possibly put them into bankruptcy? Sometimes if you have, let's say that you have 30 claimants and only $1 million or $1.5 million cap, you might be holding people who have millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical bills to collecting $20,000 or $50,000. I don't think that's what any of us intend, and that if that were to occur, we'd have those families back here just like we did with the 35W collapse, and we shouldn't have to put people like that through that situation. Specific to this committee is that under current law, if a claim is made against the Trunk Highway Fund, it would limit it to, there'd be $600,000, whatever the appropriation is, plus whatever is in the transportation fund, whatever's in the transportation budget. This would just limit it to the amount of the appropriation that's been set up for claims. So if you folks in the House sent the governor limit it to $600,000, which I believe is the current amount, that would be the most amount of money that could be come out of the Trunk Highway Fund. If the claims were larger than that, it would come out of the general fund. Under current law, what happens is it takes from the appropriation first, and then they turn and they go to your overall budget for transportation, and then next it would go to the general fund. This takes out that intermediate step, and it would just cap it at whatever your appropriation is. And with that, I'd be happy to stand for any. I didn't bring the 35W families and the testifiers because that's really not the issue before this committee. I'd be happy to have them here if you'd like at some point, but I think the issue before you is one that you're probably thinking would be a pretty good thing in terms of transportation finance.
Representative Atkins, where was this bill? I see it came from finance. We have to send it back to finance.
That's fine.
Where has the committee been, or the bill been?
We've been in civil law, Mr. Chair, and we have been in civil justice and finance. I'm trying to recall if we made another.
It goes back to finance.
I think we just go back to finance now.
Are there any questions of Representative Severs?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a few questions here. You said that there would be a limited liability in the Trunk Highway Fund of $600,000, and then it would go to the general fund. Any cap on the general fund?
And actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Severs, that's the appropriation this year, is my understanding. And I've got the memo from Mr. Burris that said it's $600,000 per year, at least recently.
So that would be within the sole discretion of the body. If you set it at $300,000, it would be $300. If you set it at $3 million, it'd be $3 million. But it's whatever that appropriation is. Then to be, with respect to the general fund, no, there would not be a cap on that. And the whole point of that is that if we have a catastrophe like we did with 35W, we shouldn't be looking to those victims to live within some cap. It should be spread out across all of us, particularly if it's our fault. If it is the state's fault, and we're talking just about purely accountability here and taking responsibility for it, that's the point of the bill.
Yeah, just to follow up with that, I got some basic problems with the whole tort litigation here. I think when we talk about we the people are the government, we are the people are responsible, and we the people are the ones that pay the bills on these things.
Right.
And when we go back to the issue of the I-35W bridge, in which there was defect in the actual trusses in the engineering process, then are we the people at fault, or was it the designer who was at fault and we failed to go after the designer? The designer didn't have the money. So I guess all of this to say, when we start pulling off the caps on these things, who's really paying the bills? And I think it is we the people. And so I've got some real questions on the whole tort issue here that I don't know, you know, goes into the venture of transportation, but I guess at this point oppose the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beard, did you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I do, and it's first of all, maybe it's a question of Representative Atkins, who's in the legal profession, but my recollection of a discussion a while ago of the why there's caps on municipalities, I think at $250,000 per occurrence, I think we, per person, or I'm trying to remember exactly.
Actually, a little bit higher than that, Representative Beard. There are caps.
There are caps. I know we cap municipalities and individual, and I think the state of Minnesota as well. And I don't know that it ran to budgetary concerns as much as there was another good governance kind of a reason why we did it. And so I'm struggling a little bit with the assertion that we did that it says in the findings. First of all, you know how I feel about findings and statute. Here's one right here, as a matter of fact. I'm not sure that I agree with the concept that the only reason we protect cities and counties and school districts is just to protect their budgets. I think there was another reason for that. And I think that cities, counties, and school districts are also able to buy insurance above and beyond the $250, if I'm not mistaken.
Mr. Chair, Representative, here they are able to do so. The point of, and I give a great deal of credit to Senator Latz, who carried the 35W bill and is shepherding this through in the Senate. The point of not including the local municipalities, the local entities, was that in terms of their ability to spread it across their taxpayers, it was in some cases, I mean, you might be talking a city or township of 50 or 100 or 200 people, and that would be considerably more difficult relative to the capacity of the state of Minnesota to live up. And I'm, by the way, Representative Stevenson, I'm only talking about situations in which the state of Minnesota is at fault. If there's somebody else that was at fault, we sure as heck shouldn't be paying. It would just be where we are at fault and where we stand up and take responsibility and hold ourselves accountable and to those people that have been harmed as a result of our errors.
Any further questions? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beard, I did go to the statute just to find out what those numbers were. And this is 466.04, liability of any municipality. Right now, the number is $400,000. On July 1st, it moves to $500,000.
Any further questions or comments? Not, you have no other testifiers for or against?
No, sir.
You didn't make the motion, did you?
No, he did, Mr. Chair.
That's what I was
saying. I'm more hopeful than if I had made the motion.
The chair, renew the motion that House File 103 be recommended to pass and be returned to the Finance Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Contrary?
No.
The motion passed and House File 103 will be returned to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The members of the committee, I'm sorry, who ran over time, but needs to finish the business.
Mr. Chair, it was very interesting.
Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.